14. Constantine, in his silence. He doesn't need to speak. From the moment the mass teleport unfolds them back into corporeality, they know that everything is wrong. Everything, perhaps, except Dawn's prognostication of deceit. Well, damn him. Damn him and his clinical Astartesian projections of strategy. Of course it was going to be deception. Of course it was going to be a trap. It's not even subtle. The waiting Neverborn pounce before they are even solid, biting and clawing at their molecular patterns while they are still resolving. Sentinel Geladen solidifies to find his subatomic integrity so disrupted he is missing his torso from the breastbone down. He topples in a cloud of scrambled cells. Companion Astrikol materializes in several pieces, which fly apart in showers of immortal blood and bounce across the deck. He does not have time to know what greeting has met him. He is dead on arrival. Sentinel Valik appears, on fire from the inside. The others in the company strike. Their reactions could not be faster, reflexes that would shame mere Astartes. From pre-flare precipitation, through materialization, through first demon murders to their first kills, barely 6 nanoseconds pass. They are at pitched combat instantly, without prelude or warning, like picked footage, edited to play from the middle of battle. They are moving and killing before Geladen hits the deck, before the pieces of Astrikol begin to separate, before Valik starts screaming. Constantine Valdor truncates the demon he appears face to face with. His power sword is in and through the thing before it can react. Its head, massive, horned, manged with disease, is still grinning in anticipation as it is sheared off its shoulders. Valdor doesn't need to speak. His command over his custodes is partly wordless neurosynergy and partly decades of relentless drill and rehearsal. The company moves as one thing, like a troop of gymnasts, their performance at once both precise choreography and acutely nuanced reaction. Their conditioning and combat formats are cured into them, practiced to the point of objective perfection, but the expression of them is ordained, demisecond by demisecond, by Valdor's neural cues. He doesn't need to speak, because there is no need for verbal command, and because there is nothing to say anyway. They are in a pit of demons. Immediate lethal force must be applied. And it is. Guardian spears lunge, stab and redress. Castellan axes hack and block. Integrated bolters and plasmics blurt and howl. Heavy adrathics roar like afterburners. Greatswords slice. Misericordias bone and fillet. Where necessary, Auromite fists and vambraces crush faces, block limbs or punch through chest walls. Valdor is older than any Primarch's son, and his collated experience of war exceeds that of any of them. For the longest while, through the grinding lifetimes of the Unification Era and the early years of the Great Crusade, he had begun to believe, without complacency, that there was nothing in creation he hadn't met and killed. The Civil War has shown him otherwise. It has revealed to him not just new, monstrous adversaries, but new forms of them. The galaxy seems to delight in presenting him with surprises. He is never surprised. Surprise is a human handicap, and comes weighted with fear and hesitation. His response always is simply curiosity. How may I learn to kill this? He applies his curiosity now, with surgical focus. He knows the Primarch children regard him as sullen and remote, like some malcontent uncle who begrudges their inheritance. They think him single-minded and stuck in his ways, unimaginative and oddly unambitious. They assume he disapproves of them, of them and their Astartes, and believes they should never have been bred or birthed. Valdor knows they think this of him, and he simply does not care. For the most part, they are entirely correct. He regards them as a profound mistake, the rare miscalculation of a brilliant mind. He considers them a disaster waiting to happen. He disapproves of them and resents them for their boisterous and petulant emotions and the undeserved glory that flows towards them like iron filings to a magnet. He sees the Civil War as an unequivocal vindication of those beliefs. But those are political beliefs and play no part in his duty, so he keeps them to himself. And the vindication gives him no pleasure, because pleasure is a human handicap and comes weighted with extenuation and prideful satisfaction. He says little or nothing on the matter, except for occasional private rumination to those closest to him, of whom there are few. He keeps his counsel. It is not his place to express an opinion. The Primarchs are also correct in thinking him single-minded, but to see this as a failing reveals only that they have no understanding of his purpose. He and those he commands were built for one task, to guard the life of the Emperor. That is his duty, impressed into him at a genetic level. The Primarchs speak of duty as though it is a solemn calling, and yet they flout it and shy from it at the slightest provocation. He is single-minded because he has a single purpose. To see that as a fault shows they have no comprehension of duty whatsoever. But they are wrong to believe him unimaginative. They would be surprised profoundly, he thinks, at his curiosity. It is a baseline requirement of his purpose to inquire, to examine, to learn, as constantly as his name implies, the nature of the galaxy, so he may perform his duty with ever greater efficiency. It makes him intellectually hungry, an appetite he sometimes feels on an acutely physical level. As the Civil War unfolded, and the unknown exoplanar threat of the Immaterium began to manifest, his mentor, he that Valdor guards, showed him a kindness and gave him a gift, the Apollonian spear. What it pierces, what it bites, it knows. It learns and transmits that learning to the hands that wield it. A weapon of revelation, a feast for a starving warrior. What Constantine doesn't know, and perhaps can never know, is whether the Emperor gave him the spear as a simple practicality to improve the performance of his duty, or if there was something more human, more unconditional in the gift. Was it just to make Valdor a more effective warrior, or did his mentor feel pity and wish to placate his constant curiosity? Did he fear, perhaps, as his gene sons rioted and turned traitor, because, allegedly, their needs were not met, that Valdor might break too? Did the Emperor think that Valdor would grow disloyal if his burning curiosity was left unsatisfied? Was the spear a bribe? An inducement to maintain loyalty and stave off resentment? An enticement to create the illusion that his needs were recognized? He trusts it is not the case. The Emperor knows him better than that, surely. The Emperor made him better than that. To suspect that of him is to think that the Emperor doubts him, and that cannot be, because doubt is a human handicap and comes weighted with mistrust and anxiety. The only way to know for sure would be to pierce the Emperor's flesh with the spear, if it could even do that, which would grant Valdor complete elucidation of all mysteries, but also entirely defeat the original purpose of his duty. Better to regard the spear as merely an instrument vital to the accomplishment of his work. Some rotting, dragonate depravity rears up at him, billowing from the shadows while being simultaneously half-made of those very shadows. Valdor ends it with his sword, a stroke that splits its body in a messial slice and opens it like a book. But his sword, fresh forged in the House of Weapons, has already chopped down two capering Neverborn with hircine heads and lariat tongues, and a massive tarantulous form with 1,000 compound eyes freckling its furred mass. The blade has begun to choke out, and some substance in the dragonate beast, some liquor or some energy, shorts out its power entirely. An emaciated giant, 4 meters tall and thos-headed, like the jackal gods of the ancient Nihilus, swings for him. Valdor ducks the sickle talons and the long, eight-jointed digits that bear them, and drives his sword in. But its energy is exhausted. Its edge is chafed and dinted, and it is now only dead metal. Metal is not enough to tear this thing's hide. Valdor backsteps, hurls the sword away, incidentally impaling some squealing lesser spawn that dared too close, and unlocks the spear from his backplate. 8 seconds into the fight, 8 seconds since materialization, and a master-crafted weapon is worn out. The Thos comes at him, hunched, head down, porpentine quills rising like hackles on the base of its skull, its dog teeth bared, a ringent grin, not of delight, but because, like a dog, it is tasting him in the air. Valdor makes no flourish. His technique is never ostentatious. With a twist of his hips, he drives the spear tip first into the thing's shrunken chest until the blade emerges through the spine. A moment. It's never pleasant. It never lasts longer than a blink or a heartbeat. Valdor waits for it to be over. Deadpan. In the blink, in the heartbeat, a mystery is transmitted through the haft of the spear into his hands, into his soul, the mystery of a grotesque and elaborate lifetime. Eons of unterrenitous existence in the blood-wept eternity of the warp, various embodiments of flesh and bone, deep ravening appetites and desires, a brief millennium worshipped as a deity by terrified priests in a shadowed temple at Saqqara. 9 more locked in a lightless mastaba, a sojourn to a seething plutonium star on the hem of the Milky Way. Pseudo-names and apocryphal titles, symbols, runes, glyphs, imprecations, prayers, rituals, allegiance to the entity of change, a name, a real name.
Mahanthit,
murmurs Valdor, uttering the dead thing's name to take power over it, and so he will remember it the next time. He jerks the spear out, and it comes free in a gout of mud-brown ichor. The Thos collapses. He twists, using the base of the haft to trip an attacker, before slicing with the blade. Another moment, another blink, another heartbeat.
Kul Kelich, he whispers.
12 seconds into the fight. The custodes have ignited their Aare shrikes to broadcast blight code that defeats and confounds any cogitators or sensoria trained on them. Adrathic weapons are turned on the largest horrors looming from the darkness. Blades and lances flens smaller forms into bloody meat or burst etheric instantiations into void mist. As they fight, the automatic systems in the custodian's war gear scan for vox, nuspheric, and psychoactive linkages, communication bands, positioning data and reference markers, and tactical connectives, hunting fast and wide with high-function cogitation capability. Valdor knew it would be a trap. Unlike Dawn, he didn't regard it as a worry to be questioned and evaluated. He knew it as an operational certainty, simply to be expected. He knew it, because the Emperor knew it too. The Emperor does not make mistakes, because mistakes are a human handicap and come weighted with ignorance and poor judgment. The Emperor would not have commanded an abscess without expecting deceit. The brat Lupercal had dared him, and he had outdared the dare by accepting. This was always going to be a fight to the death, after all, was the desired outcome. Nothing about this is surprising, Valdor. Except perhaps for the fact that he has only lost 14 men in the first 17 seconds. He blocks and thrusts, dodges scything claws and biting maws, guts and skewers, endures moments, learns names and mysteries, maintains his singularity of purpose. Then, in the thick of the melee, his suit link chimes. Search parameters exhausted. No data. He keeps killing and learning as he ponders this. No data. No available vox or data linkage. No positioning. No contact with Hegemon Control or any of the other Anabasis companies. No contact with him. He remains calm, killing a herpetine form as his mind whirs, ignoring, uncharacteristically, its name and secrets.
Where are they? Where is he? Transition should have placed them all in Embarkation Deck 2. All four companies of the Spearhead, no more than 200 meters apart.
The darkness around them, the darkness that has entombed them for all of the 20 seconds since they arrived, is impenetrable and suffocating. The others should be close. He should be close. But Valdor somehow knows they are not. Even if he couldn't see them, or hear them, or scan them, or raise them on the link, he would know. Intuitively, he would know that he was close by. He is not. And this is no embarkation deck. The walls, where visible, are taut sails of skin stretched like vocal cords. The floor is spoiled meat that extrudes fat white maggots when weight is placed upon it, like pus squeezed from a pimple. The air is a shivering etheric soup. He is not here. Valdor has no data confirming his whereabouts or proximity. Valdor doesn't even know where he is himself. He kills again, spit speaks a name, then swallows hard. He has one duty. One duty, bred for it. He pursues it single-mindedly. It is his life, the preservation of the Emperor. And suddenly, he cannot. Was that the trap? Was that the deceit? The torment that brat Lupercal chose for him? To prevent him being the only thing he has ever been? He does not panic. Others would. He does not. He doesn't even become anxious. Only those who know him best, and those would include the two custodians fighting either side of him, Proconsul Ludovicus and Warden Simacantis, would be able to detect the change in his mental state, the micro-increase in his pulse rate and breathing. They both glance at him.
Focus!
He snarls, the first verbal instruction he has issued. The rate of attack is not diminishing. It is increasing. Entire menageries of atrocity are spilling out of the tangible darkness from every side, gibbering and laughing, whispering and mewling, like rushing waves of nightmare breaking on the margent shore of sanity, breaking across his men, of whom, 23 seconds into the fight, only 79 remain alive. Are they even aboard the bastard child's ship? Did he divert their matter transmission? Change their destination using signal capture redirection? Did he send them into the webway? Did he send them into the warp itself? Sparks flurry, embers in the air. Diocletian Chorus is unloading bolt round after bolt round into a colossal tusked beast to bring it down. The concentration of shots has caught its straggled pelt alight. Tribune Diocletian has been obliged to act with such inefficient fury because the tusked thing had been about to strike Valdor, who hadn't seen it coming. Distraction had broken his focus. He nods his appreciation to Diocletian, turns, stabs a thing, half plump infant, half hornet, out of the air, mutters its name, then recomposes his formation via neurosynergetics. The demon droves multiply, living darkness becoming solid things. He is not scared. He isn't even angry, though rage is a weapon he always keeps close at hand. He hesitates to use it, because rage is a human handicap and comes weighted with imprecision and unforced error. But he will reach for it if he must. His curiosity lights him up. He needs to know. He needs to know. Not the names belonging to the participants in the misbegotten parade of murder around him, names that will simply edge him ever closer to the fringe of madness, but something true, something real, something he can fight with or against. He hefts the spear. It works against flesh, even immaterial corporeality, but not against inanimate materials. The deck, though, the deck is maggot-puckered meat. Valdor plunges the Apollonian spear into the floor, or the ground, or the deck, or whatever it is or used to be. A moment, a blink, a heartbeat, a mystery, a name. Constantin Valdor shudders. It is 25 seconds into the fight.
Vengeful spirit, he whispers.